Kate Fagan, Archives of the Present, Temporal Shift, Maternal Legacy, and Ontological Repair in the Poetry of Allie Cobby Eckerman and Natalie Harkin.
Thank you, Jean. Thank you very much to us. So much to Pam and to Kate. And I want to join my voice with many of all here in acknowledging that we are on a lonely land, and thanking the elders and ancestors, present and past, and to come, and for the great welcome that Vincent gave us. Philip Mead yesterday spoke of, reflexively situating yourself in your own critical practice, and I think Pam and Kate have just given exemplary instances of that narrative. And I'm going to say a little before I read this paper about why I came to, I suppose, the positions that I'm testing out in this paper about the maternal, about Allie Cobby Eckerman and Natalie Harkin's work. And to say that I'm increasingly feeling my way through writing about poetics as a musician, and to thinking about musicality in the books that I read. And to me, the books that I'm going to speak around partly to in the next 20 minutes are three of the most exciting Australian poetry books that I've had the fortune to read in the last few years. And I take very seriously what we do as critics in making the discourse and circulating the discourse. And I'm also a mother of two children with Aboriginal ancestry, and I want to know the story to join with them as we all move through, parenting and childing together. So there's some of the reasons why I come to this as the only work I could think of presenting in this context, and this is just one early resting point in the process of reading these works. So a little of a position of kind. I want to start by reading this work of Allie's from Ruby Moonlight, and this as a sort of stepping off point, a work called Tempo. Sunrise, days pass, sunset, leaves transmute, weeks pass, shifting stars, sunshine softens, months pass, the air cools. Winter returns. Not long after the publication in 2006 of her Miles Franklin Award-winning epic Carpentaria, leading Aboriginal author Alexis Wright wrote a striking essay on that novel's study of ancient and ongoing connections between narrative form, Aboriginal ontologies, and coexistent temporalities. For a long time, while I was exploring how to write Carpentaria, reflects Wright, I tried to come to some understanding of two principal questions. Firstly, how to understand the idea of Indigenous people living with the stories of all the times of this country. And secondly, how to write from this perspective. This fictional work could not be contained in a capsule that was time or incident specific. It would not fit into an English and therefore Australian tradition of creating boundaries and fences which encode the development of thinking in this country. I turned elsewhere to try to understand how to configure the history I know and what I understand of our realities. Carlos Fuentes, the South American novelist, once said that all times are important in Mexico and that no time has been resolved. His is a country of suspended times. That's Alexis Wright. In this paper, I want to read the poetry of Allie Cobby Eckerman and Natalie Harkin through the guiding lens of Alexis Wright's profound phrase, living with the stories of all the times. Both Eckerman and Harkin have published book-length, serialised long poems that explore a poetics of duration and temporal shift. Eckerman's Ruby Moonlight, published first in 2002 and republished very recently here by Flood Editions, Eckerman's Ruby Moonlight and Harkin's Dirty Words move deftly among contemporary realities and stories that have been told for tens or hundreds or thousands of years, many of which operate beyond philosophical and disciplinary machineries that categorise times and events as past or historical. Or perhaps more accurately, the aesthetic and cultural coordinates of Eckerman's and Harkin's poems suggest foundational Aboriginal ontologies that far exceed what I just described as a movement among temporalities. Something more in keeping with Alexis Wright's reflections upon multiple times coexisting in one instant, and on ways that works of literature might encode and enact such states of being in continuous relation. Wright is deeply wary of romanticising this trope, and this is Alexis Wright again, I wanted to question the idea of boundaries through exploring how ancient beliefs sit in the modern world, while at the same time exposing the fragilities of the boundaries of Indigenous home places of the mind, by examining how these places are constantly under stress and burdened with threat, and often forced into becoming schizoid illusions of our originality. Like Wright, Ekerman and Harkin know acutely the imaginative pressures of living in a matrix of ancient stories, many of which seem to resonate for Ali Cobby Ekerman within a recent return to traditional language, even while facing and inhabiting political and social realities that relentlessly continue to fracture, erase and ignore those stories and languages and their intrinsic links with Aboriginal country. And Ali said earlier, no justice, no law. I was thinking of that. The elegant and spare lyric Tempo is emblematic of the temporal and cultural patterns alive in Ekerman's long poem Ruby Moonlight. Each line of tempo is a marker for spatialised time, an instance of ecological fact and witness, rather than a stopping point in a linear history or story of history or duration. Each word is a note on a musical stave that resounds in its own local moment, while adding to a narrative that is both literal and allegorical. Lines work in conjunction, as might an index. They gesture towards one another and signify together, even while pointing to greater scales and spatialities. They can be read horizontally or vertically, even while pointing to greater scales. They can be read horizontally or vertically from a centre or one of many edges, and also in their entirety. Months pass, sunshine softens, stars exist in temporal flicker inside and outside the passing of a day. In less than 20 words, tempo configures ageless seasonal chronicles with singular moments of weather as they are experienced by an observing and attentive Aboriginal body. That of Ruby, who is the sole survivor of a colonial massacre. Say Ruby, who is the sole survivor of a colonial massacre of her family. And this is Ali. Leaves transmute, weeks pass. The air calls, winter returns. The stories of all the times, I'm not sure if I can. I'll just take a moment. If you want me to read them, please. Yeah, maybe I'll read it for you. It's okay. We all need sleep. And we're all somebody's child. And the stories of all the times, including those of immediate and past survival, move and rest within the elastic and sculptural field of tempo. To recall Alexis Wright's reading of Carlos Fuentes, all times are important in Ruby Moonlight and none are resolved. They suspend and sustain as chords in unbounded return to effect a kind of minimal polyphony. A similar music of movable scales is audible in Ekerman's most recent collection, Inside My Mother, embodied perhaps in the startling lines, they come to appraise the song in the amphitheatre of our mouths and the inflation of our hearts and spilling the noise of the in-between. Ekerman talks about the significance of tempo to her signature use of sparse description in a recent interview with Ben Etherington for the Wasafiri Journal of International Contemporary Writing. She twice invokes the figure of the pause to address interplays between brevity and prolonged narrative in her poetry. Rather than filling spaces that already are full in sonic and cultural senses, the poems in Ruby Moonlight and Inside My Mother conduct precise passages of connection between words and themes, between stories and their slow transmission to different readers. Pauses are inseparable from time signatures in Ekerman's poetry. Her works steadily accumulate their images and materials, stopping between them in a manner that is both harmonic and curatorial in the sense of care for discrete things and their habitats. By holding over sound from line to line, weeks pass, shifting stars, sunshine softens, months pass, I feel that Ekerman creates aesthetic and cultural room for reverberations and afterimages to proliferate. Repetition, suspension and enjambment, which are also techniques of pausing, generates space for readers to distill the temporal experience of reading as simultaneously auditory, linguistic, and phenomenal. This is not a performance of history, as Alexis Wright reminds us, but a way of understanding a poetics of relation, to cite the Caribbean Martinican theorist Edouard Glissant, in which Glissant writes, "Every detail is as complex as the whole that cannot be reduced, simplified, or normalised." In an essay entitled Concerning the Poem's Information, Glissant assembles a genealogy of archetypally modernist long poems in which he argues a poetics of duration, as full of revelation as the poetics of the moment, coheres to issue a lasting challenge to the temporal aesthetics typically privileged in European Romanticism. This paper is a shorthand. Every one of these words seems to be dropping into something very long. Glissant considers parallels between revelations in thought made available by immersion in multiple temporalities and the philosophical and experiential effects of what he describes as creolisations, post-colonial cultural processes that he argues work to bring into relation but not to universalise, and that drive a poetics of decolonisation, especially in its Caribbean expressions. In her account of Carpentaria's orchestral spiralling narrative, Wright cites Glissant in explaining why she chose not to write a historical novel. There are many reasons why I believe she didn't, but this is some of her thinking on that. "I could find no reason to write history in the sense of drawing on historical incident when all times are important and unresolved. The Indigenous world is both ancient and modern, both colonial experience and contemporary reality. I wanted to stare at difference right now as it is happening, because I felt the urgency of its pulse ticking in the heartbeat of the Gulf of Carpentaria." This is Alexis. "The beat was alive. It was not a relic. It was not bones to examine." Carpentaria is inseparably past, present and future, a work of cultural duration in place, and also what is absolutely present in singular moments, even if still becoming so. A similar weave of stories and experiential frames underscores Ali Kobiekerman's contrasting and accomplished use of minimalism within serialised narratives. "I think that if my old people could say something in its most simplistic form, they would," she observes. For Ekerman, a Yakandjari Kakapa writer, compositional precision within an arc of extended stories might be a way of joining poetic form and cultural responsibility. And in a growing sense, her role as a senior woman and matriarch within her ancestral Aboriginal family. I want to look closely at several stanzas of the lyrical poem Clay from Inside My Mother, in which Ekerman conjoins geophilosophical scales that are both vast and intensely finite. "The world is turning to clay. Its muddy weight dry on my skin drags me down below river banks, reducing the sky to a sliver. All peripheral vision is blocked by the earth. The sky allows a sight that does not end. Only my eyes reveal a myopia secret, my desire to live in the sky. I retreat to myself encased in knowing truth is bigger when reduced in size." The coexistence here of many spatio-temporal scales and realities is cradled in the book's core story of doubled loss and finding. Ekerman's reunion with and then grief at the passing of her birth mother, from whom she was separated as a baby. This reconnection is also figured within Inside My Mother as a return to Ekerman's mother's country, to ancestral kin and story networks, and to traditional language. The speaker in clay literally moves back into the earth, and from that perspective, encased in a knowing that arrives only with this newly narrowed view, she relinquishes all peripheral vision to reveal a vaster cosmology coded in the stunning phrase, "myopia secret." When I was thinking again about this poem, I realised that I think Ali Kobiekerman's achievements of crossing philosophical frames in extremely concise language are the equal of those I hear in Emily Dickinson. I think Ali is equal and different to that precision as a writer. That's just a feeling I have about the work. For a moment, a symbolic myopia or a limiting affords the speaker of this poem uninterrupted admission to a sight that does not end, which might be interpreted as a form of cultural and ontological knowledge. The word secret suggests not only culturally differentiated access to knowledge, and knowing in this place, but also the promise of a story that's still arriving and that seems inseparable from difficulty, as implied by the phrases muddy weight, its earth, voice, force, and drowned in mud. Via transformations of the poem, the speaker is carried into truth, philosophical truth, and also into a mediated place of awareness that is giant and small, it's historical and utterly present. And in the poem Ngali, named for her mother, Enkerman writes, "My mother is a granite boulder. I can no longer climb nor walk around. Her weight is a constant reminder of myself." The weight of this poetry suggests a cultural and matrilineal responsibility to stories that locate Enkerman within country, inside her mother, and alongside the shadows and epitaphs of countless mothers and children. Sit down here real quiet. These things are unbearable, and they need to be told. Sit down here real quiet. You can feel them dying, all the massacre mobs. Hearts can't make it up. When you feel the story, you know it's true, writes Enkerman in Kulila, a poem that appears to echo the many voices of senior Aboriginal women from whom she is learning about culture on her mother's land. Tell every little story when the people was alive. Tell every little story more. Might be 1 week now, might be long, long time. Sit down, sorry camp. Time, inherited stories and kin networks are embedded in the ground itself, which carries an audible resonance of historical facts that are continuous with cultural futures as projected in the unconditional present of the land. As Alexis Wright reminds us, Aboriginal stories are always already told to the land and of or from it in a relationship that's concurrently historical and genealogical and present. In a very small way, writes Alexis Wright, I would like to think that Carpentaria is a narration of the kinds of stories that we can tell to our ancestral land. Peter Minter suggests in another context that Aboriginal artworks, including perhaps literary artworks, and this is Pete, begin from an irrefutable set of actualities, the emergence of a lived cosmos in the dreaming, the contiguous emergence of language and painting and song and ceremony as materialisations of an ancestral poetics, and the present moment expression of the ethos of a place, the genealogy of its character and nature. In a sense, the artworks are simultaneously genealogical and concrete as both substance and a history of substance. Story functions in Minter's appraisal as matter, language, poesis, ethos and cosmos, a complexity that folds concisely into and from ruby moonlight. It's time to leave this pausing place. The dancer chants a song as he climbs the sacred tree. This tree is emu, his grandfather taught him that. So I'll finish by moving to Natalie's archival poetics and again just suggest a few things, perhaps resonances. The collective and familial models of story at work in the poetry of Ali Kobi-Ekerman offer a powerful critique to state-sanctioned archival histories. In one sense, as we've all been discussing, an archive works cross-historically to imply a kind of ontological commons. Archives are shared repositories of knowledge that manifest a poetics of relation, their cultural storehouses, their miscellanies, their personalised momentarily in individual visits and re-readings. They're restless and volatile, and they can use the machineries of memorialisation to enfranchise a selective number of pasts, even while predicting infinite reading futures. Historian Carolyn Steedman, in an essay called After the Archive, characterises archives as both here and there, because of the imagined accumulation of what they enclose, the living and the dead, and what has not yet been. And Steedman now goes on to cite Michel Foucault's foundational essay of Other Spaces, and I thought long and hard about how much or whether to engage in a dialogue with Foucault, because one of my purposes or aims in sounding out this work was to critique the kind of big boy approach to theorising archives, as though that theory somehow arrived in 1967 with this essay. But I wanted to put the idea of the heterotopia into the dialogue anyway to see what conversations were going on in archival theory right now. With that description, a place of all times that is itself outside of time, Foucault characterises the heterotopia as a place that is a countersite to an imperialist fantasy of cultural sameness carried on in the big project of the archive. So I wanted to think about the differences between the place of all the times, as archival theory has reified and embraced that, and Alexis Wright's idea of living with the stories of all the times, because that was really productive in my thinking and listening to this work. So I'm going to turn briefly to Dirty Words, in which Narunga writer Natalie Harkin samples from contemporary and historical Australian political records to generate what I'm calling an archive of the present, obviously riffing on the histories of the present. And this will be very brief. I've learned so much from Natalie in the last 48 hours that my knowledge of this work has changed, including that Natalie was tracing her matrilineal ancestry directly in the archive, which completely changes this reading, looking for her Nana, finding her Nana's words. So I had felt that she was hearing the voices of Aboriginal women, and she was touching her Nana. So that has changed this reading, which now is, you know, 1 second ago and more. Nonetheless, let's have a quick look at D. Domestic, which ends with Apron Sorrow. Natalie Harkin's excavations are restoring erased Aboriginal cultural and social histories to colonial archives, and uncovering ways in which current Australian public discourse continues to recycle and extend aspects of the colonial project via post-colonial channels almost 2.5 centuries after English settlement. So when we look at this poem, we see Natalie Harkin revisiting a racist history of legalising the removal of Aboriginal children from their families and a subsequent placement of many girls into domestic service in non-Aboriginal households, the story of Natalie's Nana, I learned. So Harkin is stitching together samples here from diverse archival and historical texts, including evidence tabled at the 1913 South Australian Royal Commission on Aborigines, articles from the archaic weekly magazine The Australian Woman's Mirror, which was founded in the Bulletin, by the Bulletin in 1924, 1928 report from the Australian Aborigines Progressive Association, and more recent writings by Aboriginal author and activist Jackie Huggins that were published first in 1994 in a collaborative exhibition entitled White Apron, Black Hands. These genealogies are so important to state and restate, especially in this context. Harkin is using a collaging technique to break open the archive, unpicking and reworking fragments of historical documents to enable recuperation of Aboriginal bodies and voices that have been buried and made silent. The language of Harkin's colonial sources is violently assimilationist. A compulsory, systematic placing of them out is necessary. They are lazy, with all their drawbacks. The gins are more or less handy. These subjectivities, Aboriginal ontologies and experiences within these cogs of power and historical control are being recovered as resistant by Natalie Harkin, I think. And a story that commemorates survival and connection and resistance is appearing for us in the broken open archive here, with phrases like she's very fond of her own people and is looking forward to going home, or the parents interfere so much. And I think, again, the significance of a history of resistance to colonisation cannot be overstated. It's incredibly important as a fundamental counter to the kind of inertia position on territory that is underpinning that crown claim to Australian place, both in establishing settlement and in wrongfully annulling sovereign rights to land that's still in here for me. And many. Harkin concludes this poem with a lyric that she writes from the point of view, I said first, of a young Aboriginal girl, and now I say possibly of Natalie's Nana, one of thousands subjugated during colonial settlement, with whom Harkin perhaps she's listening to her Nana between these pages. Apron folds and pockets keep secrets pinned, tucked, hidden. They whisper into linen shadows that flicker float with the sun. Hung limp on the breeze, they slay a rhythmic sorrow. So here, poetic form, it becomes, I think, a direct way of honouring the material lives and labours of these girls and women taken from their families. And Natalie Harkin is undertaking a very radical and new kind of piecework, I think, to create this archive of present sorrows that are tucked and hidden into the rhythms and shadows of these historical documents. And I'll finish by drawing a resonance with a poet, a Caribbean-Canadian poet who I admire enormously, Edna Bassey-Phillip, and just reading a little from an interview with the Caribbean literary scholar Patricia Saunders, who is based at Miami. Nobesi Phillip is talking about her serial poem Song from 2008 and how she was looking for a form of writing that she says can and will bear a burden of ancestral stories of slavery, that Philip will never tell in their entirety and that are unbearable to tell. So this is Norbasi Philip. At the end of the acknowledgements, I thank the ancestors for giving me the responsibility of bringing this story forward, because it is a tremendous responsibility. The archive is much more unstable than we originally thought. It's complex because we need language, we need grammar, we need all of those things, but we also need to use them in a different way. I think this is what Zong is attempting to find, a form to bear the story which can't be told, which must be told, but not through telling. There is always a search, a restless search perhaps for space among the words in the text, always a seeking out of space, as if the words are seeking to breathe. The pauses and spaces and temporal shifts of Zong, the music of Zong, resonate with the aesthetic inventions of Ali Kobi Ekerman and Natalie Parkin in finding poetic forms to bear the collective responsibilities and weight of ancestral and current stories that remain both impossibly difficult and vital to tell and hear. In such a scenario, Alexis Wright reminds us, and without settling for one explanation of the book while others can be imagined, Carpentaria, this is Alexis, is the land of the untouched, an indigenous sovereignty of the imagination, just such a story as we might tell in our story place, something to grow the land perhaps or to visit the future. There are no rocks, no constants, the tide laps gently, echoes Ali Kobi Ekerman. On the horizon, sunset appears and the colours stretch. Twilight will arrive like vows that sustain the sky. Stars burst in a global dance.